Ferris B'nai Torah presents The Shmooze, an engaging and motivating Mussar and Hashkafa series that deals with real-life issues.
Tonight's shiur, the food is, we'd like to thank for sponsoring Mr. and Mrs. Yehuda Itzchowitz. The tapes this evening are sponsored by Rabbi and Mrs. Eliyahu Katz for Refuah Shalema for Bracha Bas Liba. Last week we discussed what it was like to be a Mitzri in Mitzrayim. What it was like living through obvious miracles, and the particular point we were focused on last week was the fact that oftentimes people make a mistake. They assume that overt and obvious miracles will make a person believe, that if a person were to see a nes, they would become a mamin. And the reality is, the Mitzrim lived through 10 months, 10 months of Hashem showing them step by step that He created the world, that He maintains the world, that He orchestrates the world, and they did not come to Emuna. And on a certain level, that makes sense. They had an agenda, they had a bias, they were not interested in belief. They were Ovdei Avodah Zarah. Their belief system was that idolatry was the focus, and their assumption was that Moshe was involved with a different type of idolatry, maybe more sophisticated, maybe more powerful, but certainly not the concept of a creator. But the point is, the reason why they didn't come to Emuna was because they had a bias. However, the Klal Yisrael had no bias. The Jewish nation, as a matter of fact, if anything, our bias at the time was to believe in Hashem. Here, Hashem's coming after 210 years and telling us that He's going to redeem us, He's going to save us from our bondage, from our slavery. And in fact, if anything, the Klal Yisrael's netiyah, their inclination, their predisposition, is to believe. And we also know that Hashem was very, very particular in demonstrating Hashem's control over every facet of nature. Each one of the makas, if you study them, focuses on Hashem's control of another aspect, another facet of nature. The primary reason why Hashem did that was so that the Jewish people should come to Emuna, so that the Jewish people then, we now, should have our bedrock, our pillar that we rely on. That one time in history Hashem revealed Himself, Hashem showed how much everything is dependent on Hashem's control, and that was the one time in history that Hashem was revealing Himself. So we would assume that the Bnei Yisrael reached a very, very high level of Emunah. We would assume that they reached a level of Emunah that was actually palpable, that one could feel. They knew Hashem's presence with total clarity. And the reality is, at a certain point, they did. Chazal tell us that by Kriyas Yamsuf, when the sea was actually split, at that point, the common maid servant, the smallest, least sophisticated person in the Jewish nation, saw that which the greatest Nevi'im could not see. A prophet is one who totally, totally disassociates himself with this world and is able to see Hashem clearly. The greatest level of Nevuah that a Navi reached was surpassed by the simplest person at Kriyas Yamsuf. And the reason why that's very interesting is because prior, right before Kriyas Yamsuf, after living through 10 months of Makkos, after being chased out of Mitzrayim, after running into the Midbar, the Klal Yisrael now find themselves with their backs up against the sea, and they were petrified. They were so afraid of the Mitzrim chasing them down that the Pasuk is very clear, Vayiru Ma'od, they were filled with fear, Vayitzaku B'nei Yisrael El Hashem, the B'nei Yisrael cried out to Hashem. And listen to what the next Pasuk says. The next Pasuk says, Vayomru Amoshe, they said to Moshe, Amabliyein Kvarim B'Mitzrayim, weren't there sufficient graves in Mitzrayim? Lakachtan Olamos B'Midbar, you had to take us out to the desert to die? The Klal Yisrael assumed that they were going to be murdered. When they saw the Mitzrim chasing them down, when they saw the Mitzrim hot on their heels, they assumed it was over. They assumed there was no recourse. They were going to be killed. And the Ebenezer is bothered by the obvious question. The obvious question is, these people lived through 10 months. 10 months of seeing the most powerful, civilized nation on the planet being taken from a position of power and wealth to being destroyed. They lived through 10 months of miracles. They lived through that nation which no slave, not one slave, had ever escaped from. Now an entire nation escapes. And now camped on the Yam, they are 600,000 strong. between the ages of 20 and 60, the men alone were 600,000. So the Evan Ezra said it's absurd. Why wouldn't 600,000 men get up and fight? Why wouldn't they be victorious? What in the world were they afraid for? And Evan Ezra calls this, he says, Yesh l'tamoa, it's a tema, it's a wonderment, how they could be afraid, how they cannot stand up for their lives, for their children. And then he says an answer. He says, Atshuva ki amitzrim ayu adonim l'Yisrael. The answer is that the Egyptians were the masters to the Jews. This generation that was now coming out of Mitzrayim, says Evan Ezra, Lamad minura, learned from their youth, Lizvol ol Mitzrayim, to put up with the yoke of the Egyptians, v'nafsho shefala, and they were lowly of spirit. This generation had been born into slavery. From their youth, they had been exposed to the idea that the Mitzrim were their lords, the Mitzrim were superior, we are the inferior race, and because they were born into that mentality, says Ibn Ezra, they couldn't escape it, and in fact, they would have been murdered on the Yam. And that's the Ebenezer's answer, slave mentality. Meaning, granted, physically they should have won, but their mentality prevented them. But the only problem is, if you think about this Ebenezer, it almost sounds like he didn't answer his kasha. The question was very, very powerful. 600,000 men who have a grudge, who have a tremendous, tremendous sense of anger at the people who are now attacking them. Keep in mind, the Mitzrim who are now chasing down the Jewish nation were their taskmasters. These were the people who beat them, beat their parents, maybe murdered their children. You would assume that there's such a fury, such an anger, such a desire for revenge, that that alone would have given the Bnei Yisrael the strength to destroy their attackers. But what makes it even worse than that is Ebn Ezra himself says a little bit earlier that the Pasuk says that there were 600 Rechev Bochor. Paro set out to chase down the Bnei Yisrael with 600 chariots. Many Rishonim learned that those were just the Rechev Bochor, the chosen chariots, but there were plenty more along. But the Ebn Ezra says that's not pshat. The Ebn Ezra says there were 600 chariots, meaning Paro launched his army, what was left of it. Keep in mind, all of the animals of the Mitzrim were killed in the various makas. The only animals they had left were the few that were from the Mitzrim who were Yerelokim. He launched an offensive with 600 chariots, but that was it. Maybe some infantry, but not a huge army. So if that's true, if you do the math, you have a real tema. If you have 600 chariots and 600,000 men, so just imagine, here we are, 1,000 men per chariot. Like, what's the game? I mean, you have 6 horses and some foot soldiers in the chariot. I mean, 1,000 men can't kill one chariot? It's almost like, it's almost unintelligible. And I think, when you hear the answer, I believe is a pshat, I think we'll see an amazing chiddush. And my friends, I think the answer is that the Ibn Ezra really spelled out very clearly what he was saying. And that is, intellectually, the Jews knew that we could vanquish our enemies, it would be a romp. We outnumbered them, and even worse, Ibn Ezra says, we left Biyad Rama, we left equipped for war. Biyad Rama, says Ibn Ezra, means when the Bnei Yisrael left, we had Kaya Imam Kol Kli Mechoma, all types. When we left Mitzrayim, we left with all types of implements of war. There's no question that intellectually, had you asked the Jews then, could we win? Of course we could win. But the problem is that was intellectually. Emotionally, in their emotional being, in the modus operandi, they were brought up as slaves, they were slaves, and in their mentality, that's who they were. Here they were being attacked by their masters, the superior race. We, the lowly slaves, are now being attacked. We can't win. Not that we can't win physically, but we can't win mentally. We're bound into this slave mentality, we're bound into this box that will not allow us to win, and in fact, the Ibn Ezra says they would have been murdered, man, woman, and child. And I think it's an amazing illustration to how one's sense of self, how one's understanding shapes the totality of their being and can affect everything that they do. Again, we're talking about dying. We're not talking about not reaching your potential. We're not talking about not aspiring for greatness. We're talking about dying because you have a certain mentality. You have a certain slave mentality and you can't break out of it. And says Ibn Ezra, that's exactly what would have happened. And I think it's an amazing, amazingly important concept, because typically we like to think that we're intellectual, we're thinking people, and we create our belief system and our value systems based on our understanding. And I think we fail to realize quite how much we human beings are affected by the culture in which we live, by the times in which we live, by the way we're brought up. Now, ideally, a person should be a well-worked-out person who thinks about life, who understands his purpose in being, and creates his self-image, creates his image, his value system based on his understanding. But the reality is rarely that way. I remember the Rishiva told us his father, Rav David, was a Rishiva in America in the Depression era. And he was dirt poor. The Rishiva told us that his father, I mean, you can't imagine the poverty that people lived in those days, and particularly if you were a Rishiva in that days. And when the Rishiva describes his father in those days, he says he was a prince in pauper's clothing. His clothing were ripped, his shoes were worn out, but the man had such a stately manner. There was such a godless odom. When he walked, there was a carriage, a princely demeanor. You could see he was a man of stature. That's a person who, despite the social setting, despite his life setting, created an image for himself, had an understanding about the importance of a human, the importance of an odom, and created his self-image despite the culture. But typically, that's not what happens. Typically, we're affected greatly by the times that we live in, by the value systems of people whom we live amongst. It affects us, and oftentimes it shapes our way of thinking and our way of being to an extent that rarely do people really understand how much it really affects them. I was at a bar mitzvah, and a person got up to speak. And this man managed, in a very few short words, to insult the Baal Simcha and speak literally divrei apikorsis that had my hair almost standing on end. And within just a few minutes of an innocent-sounding Dvar Torah, and I'll tell you what he said. The person, the father there, was a Baal Tshuva who had spent many years in yeshiva and really developed and worked himself into a very, very well-worked, well-developed person. The person who got up to speak wanted this person's parents to feel at home. His parents, the Baal Simcha's parents, were not from. So he wanted them to feel more comfortable. So what he said was the following. He said, you know, it's such a wonderful Simcha, and I must tell you, the Baal Simcha we have here, who he is because of his parents. What he learned in the house was social justice. What he learned in the house was a value system. All that was lacking was some rituals. That he learned. But who he is was from his house. Now, while it was a nice idea, what he was saying was so scary. Because what he was saying was that Judaism is a bunch of rituals. You know, you put on the phylacteries, you put on the four-cornered garment. My friends, this was a man who worked on himself. He was brought up in liberal Americanism, and he worked on himself to develop his mindset, to develop his value system, to develop a Torah-conscious personality, so that his everything he did was according to the Torah. That which he felt was important, that which he believed in, that which he valued, his whole life was the Torah. And to say that the Torah is rituals and just things you do is such a far cry from reality that it's again, it frightened me, because he clearly was missing the boat. You have to understand, we have a mission and an objective as Jews to become developed people. That means if I were born in the 50s in the communist Russia, or if I was born in the 30s in Japan, my value system, my belief system, that which I feel is important, that which I focus on, that which I teach my children should be no different. Because if there are truths, if there are ultimate truths, and if the Torah is that ultimate system of truth, my objective, my job is to make that my belief system, to make that that which I focus on, that which I do. And folks, I want to, before I finish this point, to really explain what I mean, I want to mention something of interest. Twice a day we say in Shema, do not veer off after your eyes and after your hearts. In our day and age, we all pretty much understand the issue of not veering off after one's eyes. And anyone who's learnt for more than 5 minutes in yeshiva understands that there's a lot that a person has to focus on. But typically, the first words that we say, l'sasur acharei levavchem, has no meaning to us. What do you mean, don't veer off after your heart? That, the Gemara tells us, avodah zarah, apikorsis. Who does that apply to? Who's involved in apikorsis or avodah zarah? But the Bir Halacha says, you know what is apikorsis? Says the Bir Halacha, apikorsis is any machshava zora, any strange thought, shem hepach das Torah, that's the opposite of Torah thought. Any value system, any belief system, any priority you have in your life that's opposite of the Torah is apikorsis. And I think when we start focusing on something, I think we'll see that it's not so simple. It's not so simple. I spent many years teaching high school, and Rabbi Davidowitz, the Rosh Yeshiva in Rochester, told me many times, the focus of a high school shmooze, 4 years, you should focus on one thing. Teach the guys not to think like a goy. Teach them to think like a Jew. Teach them to understand life as a Jew. Teach them to understand morality, ethics, values. Teach them to understand what they're here as a Jew. And I want you to understand that that's exactly what the Ebenezer is saying. What these people didn't do, what the Dor HaMidbar were incapable of doing, was they couldn't shake off the shackles of slavery, because that was the culture in which they were brought up. They were brought up as slaves, that was their mentality, that was their culture, that's who they became, and they were so locked into that box that they couldn't free themselves from it. Hence, they would have, in that case, died. But the Dor HaMidbar didn't have a Torah. We do. The focus of a Jew is to guide himself by the words of the Torah, to create his Weltanschauung, his worldview, his understanding of life by the Torah, so that I can wake up in the morning and say my view of life, what I value, what's important, what's significant, is not because of the culture. It's not because I'm influenced by the passing winds of society. Those things that people value now and 10 years from now or 20 years from now or 50 years from now are considered valueless. Do you know one of the most painful experiences for a human being? Were those people who were brought up in communist Russia. And I mean the school teachers, the ones who were brought up in the 40s and the 50s and taught this stuff like gospel. They would get up there in classroom and teach the communist theory of life. They were taught it, they taught it. And when the USSR fell, when it crumbled, when Russia couldn't feed its own and it was obvious that the system was bankrupt, that the system couldn't work, they were left with such an emptiness, because that which they believed in, that which was important to them, that which they were willing to sacrifice for, they then understood was bankrupt. And it's got to be one of the most painful things when you suffer for something, when you work on something, when you value it, and you later come to realize not only is that not a valuable concept, not only is it bankrupt, but you really understand they weren't really your values. They weren't things that you really felt were important, but you were hypnotized by the culture, by the times you were in. Now, my friends, I want you to know, this yesod is a very big deal yesod. That I am given the task, the mission to shape my life's view, my goals, my aspirations based on the Torah is a very, very important yesod for life. And I almost don't want to make an application to this. Because this yesod alone, understanding how easily a person is influenced, and seeing the mitzvim, seeing the Jews, seeing that they would have died, that's how much their mindset was shaped by their culture. Just understanding that fact and understanding that my job is not to be affected by the culture, that alone is a tremendously important yesod, and I almost don't want to dilute it. So if it weren't for the fact that I think the application that I want to speak about is very, very nogea, I wouldn't. But since it is, I want to share with you that thought. And that thought is as follows. When I was a boy, my father had an aunt whose name was Tanta Paula. And Tanta Paula was an unusual woman. She came over in the 20s. And she was a very entrepreneurial individual. She opened a retail store on the west side, and she was very successful. And this was very unusual, especially for a woman. And she was clearly a competent person, and she was accustomed to doing a lot. And she was accustomed to being involved in many, many, many things. As it turns out, I met Tanta Paula from time to time, but my most vivid memory of her is when she was already an older woman. And my father took my brother and myself to the home. And she was then already, as they say, now we know it as Alzheimer. Then we weren't as sophisticated, it was called, she was Nishtangansen, but she was already, as they say, she wasn't really fully there. And I remember vividly the following scene. We come to the nursing home, we come in, the nurse calls Tanta Paula. Tanta Paula comes in her house coat, smoking a cigarette, and says, "Oh, you came to visit. It's such a pleasure to see you. Oh, I'm so glad, Eddie, the boys, I'm so glad. Listen, I'm sorry, I have no time to talk. I'm very busy, but I really appreciate it. I'm going to see you later. Thank you for coming." And she smokes on the cigarette, goes by to the nurse. "Oh, it's a pleasure to see you today. You look so good, Marjorie. I'm sorry, I have no time. I hope you'll excuse me, but I have to go on. I hope you be well, be well." She goes to some of the people that are sitting there. "You look so good. I have no time. I wish I could sit and chat. I have no time. I'm sorry." She went around the whole day that way. And she came back maybe 15 minutes later. "Oh, Eddie, I'm so glad you came with the boys. I wish I had time to talk. I'm just too busy. I'm sorry. I have no time to talk." Now, gentlemen, listen to what I'm saying to you. This was a woman who unfortunately was at a stage of dementia. She was losing it. But gentlemen, if you look around our society today, I claim you find many people with Tanta Paula syndrome. People today are so busy, 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 yoman v'layla, morning to night, so busy. And oftentimes, I'll be honest with you, oftentimes I mamish see Tanta Paula in front of me because I know these people. They're not tycoons. They're not CEOs of major corporations. They're not people. The culture, the times we live in propagates this busyness, this activity, this level of busy, busy, busy. It becomes part of the culture, and it's such a part of our life that I think we don't even realize it. There's a book that's worth reading. Goleman wrote a book called Emotional Intelligence. There's a quote he says. He says as follows. He says, "External stresses have become so great that even strong families are falling apart. The hecticness, instability, and inconsistency of daily family life are rampant in all segments of our society, including well-educated and well-to-do. The status of American children and families is as desperate as ever." Meaning, there's a hecticness, there's a busyness. Do you know they do studies? They do family studies, and this is not an atypical case. They do studies where they monitor how much time the parents spend actually communicating to the children. And they found, not unusual, a case where the father spent on average 57 seconds a night. He lived in the same house as his child, but he's going, she's going there, back, forth, boom, boom, boom. 57 seconds of actual communication time, of actually talking. Here, there's something called the American Use of Time Project, which is a long-term study of understanding how Americans use their time. And this is what the report showed. In 1965, 25% of Americans felt hurried. It was a significant part of the population who felt that they were hurried already. In 1978, the percentage went up to 28. In 1985, when they repeated the study, it was totally different. Because now the reports were people felt hurried all the time. In fact, 32% of people felt hurried all the time. And in 1992, 38% of people felt hurried all the time. I gotta go, be there, do that. People to see, places to go, things to do. Busy, busy, busy all day long. And I want you to know, historically, this is not the way it was. I'll give you a quick illustration. I had to do some research to find this one. There was a a chronicle called the Annals of Wales. How do you discover, how do you find out life in the medieval times? I mean, who was around? There was no, there was no CNN back in the Middle Ages, right? So there is a chronicle, over 500 years, there was a chronicle in Wales that basically kept the records of the Welsh, all of the kings, the wars, the real news of the time. And if you look at this over 500 year chronicle, you find interesting things. Each year has one or two incidents written down. In 570, Gildas, the wisest of Britain, died. In 573, the Battle of Alfred between the sons of Alfred happened. In 574, Brennan of Birr died. In 595, the death of Columba. Each year, ironically enough, there are some years, like 667 and 668, that are blank. Blank. And according to one version of the chronicle, they weren't just blank, but the chronicler wrote down these words: nothing happened. Nothing happened. I mean, there was nothing of significance. There were no wars. Nobody really died, so nothing happened. So the chronicler's job it was to write, wrote, nothing happened. 2 years. 2 years. Gentlemen, the World Almanac of 2004 contains 1,008 pages. 1,008 pages to detail 1 year of modern history. And it's not because we've become prolific writers. It's that because so many things are happening. There are world changes, world order changes, technological explosions. There's a whole gamut of things happening. In fact, if you study the past 100 years, if you look at the world order changes, if you look at the change in lifestyle, if you look at the change in the average man's life during 100 years that we've been living in, you'll find that more has changed in this 100-year span than has in the previous 2,000 years. Remember, a little more than 100 years ago, the average American had no electricity, there were no cars, there were planes were non-existent, there was no, you basically, by the way, 70 years ago, most of Tennessee didn't have electricity. People would chop wood, people would be tailors working by hand. 100 years ago, life was so radically different than it is now that we can't even relate to it. And the reality is that we've been bombarded by change. There's so much happening so quickly, so many things, and the wheel spins quicker and quicker and quicker, because if changes began in the 20s and the 30s, they're increasing now at a much more rapid pace. And there's an interesting effect of that many changes in the way of life. Rabbi Duritz once explained to me something interesting. We human beings have a natural way of telling time. Not only do we have a clock that runs and governs our entire bodily functions, but there's a certain natural sense of time that a person has. The way a person tells time usually is by activities that happen. On a typical day, two or three events happen. What happens to a person if there a lot of things happen, if in one weekend many, many events happen, not just three, but 10 different things, this happens, that happened, a kid gets sick and they have to go to the hospital, and then what happens is their sense of time becomes distorted. Because we gauge things, we have this internal clock that we gauge things based on activities. But when there's all of a sudden a lot of things happening, our whole clock and our whole sense of time gets all over, like a fuse blows, and we lose our sense of time. My friends, I'm telling you, there is so much happening. So much happening in our times. There's such a frenzy. There's so much busyness, not just in our own life, but everything that we experience. There's so much that people lose their sense of time. And the busyness that we experience, this need to move, to go, to do, to constantly be on the run, talking on the cell phone with the PDA, with the ringing. You know, it used to be enough. My Palm Pilot used to have, it was sufficient that it had 15-minute slots for appointments. It's no longer enough. It's broken down now to 6 minutes because, hey, you got to come on every minute. It's an abnormalcy. And if you want to know what I'm talking about, I'll show you a very clear example. When I was a boy growing up, I watched TV. Now, when I went to yeshiva, the TV went away, and I sort of found myself some 20 years after the fact, sort of like Chunya Magal, or who's the American, Rip Van Winkle, like I came to this afresh. And I found something very, very unusual. It was a different TV than the one I watched as a kid. And I don't mean in terms of the appropriateness. I mean, if you look at old TV programs, I Love Lucy, Gilligan's Island, maybe you guys remember The Honeymooners, right? The Honeymooners. Everything was so slow. Gleason would be on there. Alice, you better watch it. Bang, zoom, whop, up to the moon, Alice. Everything cut in slow. The scenes opened up slow. The scenes closed slow. It was like a nice, it was like TV on Valium, right? You look at the stuff now. It's moving, hopping, boom, boom, fast. I can't watch TV. I cannot watch a Coke commercial now. There's so much intensity of motion. I'm like, get me to Valium. I mean, it's just like, give me a break. It's just like, slow down. I got to, come on, I got a heart. You know what I mean? Like, the intensity, the movements, the vibrancy, the busyness is dizzying. And the media is just a finger pulse of society. Because we live in a times where things are moving, things are happening, people are busy, people got places to go, things to do, people to talk to. I got no time. And my friends, I want you to understand, this is it's a disease. It's a disease that has itself a very, very high cost. I'll give you one more example just so you understand. When you elect a president, that's a big deal for the country. Electing a president is going to be the leader for the next 4 years, arguably the next 8 years, that's going to shape the destiny of the country. They did a study, a Harvard researcher did a study, that back in 1968, when presidential candidates were given a chance to speak on TV, they were given 42 seconds. They were limited. They were given 42 seconds to say their piece, and that's limited, believe me. They're now, in 1998, they were given 9 seconds. We live in a soundbite generation. There's no communication. The president knows when he writes a speech, they have to write the soundbites in, because that's all that's going to be played. It's going to be hype. It's going to be fast. It's going to move. And every person is going to hear not the 60 minutes. They're going to hear the 6 seconds, the 8 seconds, that soundbite, because that's the society we live in. And my friends, I want you to know there's a real cost to this. You want to know the real cost? The real cost is, I'll just illustrate with a story. There was a CEO of a large, large corporation who retired. And at his retirement dinner, now you have to understand, this is a black tie affair. This is big deal. This is corporate America. And he's now stepping down. And he gets up to the podium to speak. And he looks around the room and he says, I see that many of you want my job. I just want you to know my job comes with a price. My daughter recently got married. I don't know my daughter's friends. I don't know what books my daughter reads. I don't know what her favorite activities are. In short, I don't know my daughter. That's the price you have to pay for my job. I don't think it's worth it. And he stepped down. And gentlemen, listen what he was saying. You know what he was saying? Here's a successful, talented man who worked for 25 years. He did nothing but focus on his career. And he was grand at it. He reached the pinnacle. CEO of a major corporation. Everyone was envious. But he was so busy, so focused on that goal, that at the end of it, when he retires, he says to himself, idiot that I am, what did I do? My family, I didn't know. That values that I consider really important, I blew. And it's a very painful thing to wake up after 20 years, 25 years, and say, I blew it. And not because I was lazy, and not because I wasn't working. I was busy, very actively engaged, but I stopped doing that which I truly valued. And my friends, I want to tell you something. Most people you meet have two diverse systems. There's their value system, and if you ask them about it, they'll tell you it, and then there's their life. Rarely are the two in sync. Most people spend their life doing many, many things, certainly being busy and active and doing. And if you ask them, is that your real value system? Is that what you really want to pursue? Rarely do you find the answer to be yes. And it's an amazing thing. Because the Mesillas Sharim says the most basic thing a human being must do is take time out and stop the busyness and think. As a matter of fact, says Mr. Lasham, it's even more than that. He says this is one of the tricks of the Yetzer Hara. One of the greatest tricks of Yetzer Hara is to keep the person busy. And you know what his raya is? He brings a proof from Paro. And listen to this. And when you do that exercise and you take the next step, you find those areas that are in sync and you say to yourself, good going. You find those areas that are not getting you to the place where you want to be, and you begin the planning. You begin the stages of development to get yourself to that point. You do something amazing. You begin really, really growing. You begin really growing, and you do something, again, that's so rare in our time. In our day and age, we live in amazing, amazing times. Never before on the face of the planet, never in history, has there been so much material wealth available. We have labor-saving devices, we have luxuries, we have extraordinary, extraordinary wealth. And yet, despite our extraordinary wealth, we are impoverished, we are poor. If you could take a person from a third world nation, imagine a guy with a spear and a loincloth, and he would come into our society, he would look at us and say, Nebuch, you got all day long running, doing, going, you don't have a chance. When do you just stop? When do you just stop and think? When do you just stop and stop the busyness? And after all said and done, if you finally got a chance to get some control of your life, came along the new invention, the cell phone. Heavy Omer, the jail cell phone, because that's what it is. You have a jail cell. When you carry it in your pocket and it beeps or it rings or it vibrates, and you gotta answer it. It doesn't matter who you're talking to. It doesn't matter how important what you're doing is. The phone rang. Oh my goodness. Yeah, oh, wow. And you find out, who is it? Was it really, really worth stopping what you're doing? Of course not. But I'm a slave. I am married to this, I am bonded to this, and I can't free myself from the shackles. Am I any different than the Jews who had the slave mentality? Gentlemen, I don't mean to be facetious here, I'm very serious. If our culture, if the busyness of our time shapes our value system, shapes our beliefs, affects us, changes us, makes us live in a way different than we really wish to, then we're subject to exactly the same fallacy. And that's, I think, the big yesod Ibn Ezra is teaching us. If you want to understand how much a culture, how much a way of life, how much at times affect the person, Ibn Ezra says, study those people, thinking, intelligent people who knew that they could in a heartbeat destroy the Mitzri army. They knew they were armed, they knew they were more powerful, but their mindset was totally boxed into a slave mentality and they couldn't escape it. And we, no matter what generation, no matter what times, we're affected by the culture. Hashem gave us a Torah. The Torah is the ultimate antidote. It's the pure emes given by the creator of the heavens and the earth as man's marching orders, as man's directive. If I can gain a perspective, a Torah perspective on life, if I can gain a perspective of values based on the Torah, if I could shape myself to it, I become a free man. But you have to work on it. I'm telling you, my friends, in our generation, you have to work. It's a crazy thing. You know, in my house, the little kids know if the phone rings during dinner, if a kid answers, they're in big trouble. They're in big trouble because we made a rule. We made a rule. There's a thing called dinner time. Dinner time means we sit as a family at the dinner table and we communicate. Talk. We talk. And no one else is invited. It's a private group. No one else, whether you're a telemarketer or you're an important, it doesn't matter. No one answers the phone. We shut the phone off. Oh my goodness, it's my PDA. It's mine. I'm busy. I got to stop the share. I'm sorry. I'd love to go on, but I'm sorry. I'm too busy. I'm sorry. Tante Paul is calling me. I'm sorry. Help you. Excuse me. Right. It's here. It's go. I'm married. I got to do it. I have no choice here right now. Is it crazy? How many times during the day does the palm ring, the phone ring? I can't. Do you have any menuchas and nefesh? Do you ever shut it off and just think? The answer is I can't. I was brought up in America in the 21st. I can't do it. But gentlemen, what I'm saying is it's a very important point. To break free from this cultural malaise, from this disease, you have to do that critical step of thinking, stopping the busyness, stopping the activity, just taking time to think. And what am I thinking about? I'm thinking about my values. What do I want out of life? What do I value? Am I living my life in accordance with what I value? It's a chesh ben nefesh. It's something that a person rarely does. And it takes training. It takes training. Tantapola syndrome is a pretty serious syndrome. It affects people. It permeates society. Everything you do, and if you don't break free, you live your life shackled to it. If a person breaks free, they can plan their life and become somebody. I want to close with a story. It's actually, it's basically something the Vilna Gaon, the Gros says. Excuse me. The Gros says that a person has a lot of pain throughout his life. All pain has a purpose, but no matter who you are, you're going to suffer. Different people have different pains, but everyone suffers a certain amount of pain. Says the Gros that if you can imagine all of pain that you'll suffer your entire life, there's no pain that begins to compare to that moment after you leave this earth. After you leave this earth, and they bring you in front of the Beis Din Shamala, and they hold up a picture, of this great man, this man of sterling character traits, this man who knew Shas and Poskim, this man who everyone admits is a great human being. And they say to you, why isn't that you? And I say, me, that great man, a little me, what do you want from me? And then says the Gros, they say those most telling words, that is you. That is you had you made yourself into what you were created to be. That is you had you shaped yourself into what you were destined to be. And says the Gros, that is the most painful moment in a person's life, because then I wake up. Then I realize, oh my goodness, I was here for a purpose. I was here to shape myself, to mold myself, to grow. And now it's over. And at that point, the Gros says, all a person wants to do is run back. Give me another chance. Let me change. Let me grow. Let me change. Let me go back. But then it's too late. But gentlemen, this is a very, very heavy thought, but very, very powerful. As long as I am alive, I can change. And if some point in my life I could see that moment, I could see that moment where they're holding me there and they're saying, why aren't you that? If I can envision that while I'm alive, I have the greatest opportunity that a human being ever can have. I have an opportunity to wake up and change myself. And gentlemen, do you know what it's like to wake up in the morning? To wake up in the morning and say, wow, thank you Hashem for creating me. Thank you for giving me this day, because this is a day that I can shape myself, I can mold myself, I can grow. That sense of joy, of empowerment, of understanding life, and then going about the difficult task of actually changing is one of the most beautiful and joyful experiences a human being can have, and it's also one of the rarest, because most people, I have to tell you folks, most people do not think. If you're a Baal Musar, if you learn Musar on a regular basis and you sit down every day to a Musar Seder, you set away time, maybe. The Mesil Lasharim says these words. He says a person should set aside time every day. I promise you, the Mesil Lasharim was a bigger masmid. He was busier than any person you could ever met. But there was a difference. He wasn't squandering his time. He wasn't busy with Tantapola syndrome. He was busy with a plan. Excuse me. He was busy with a goal. And he took time out. And he counsels, he suggests, stop. Stop the busyness. Stop the activity. Take time to plan. Take time to think. Think about your goals. Think about your aspirations. Think about what you want out of life. And then plan your life. Plan your life and then live your plan. If a person does this, they reach heights, they live a totally different life, ultimately they reach great, great heights, and they live as Hashem created a human being to live.
You've been listening to The Shmooze, presented by Teferis B'nai Torah. For more information on The Shmooze, please visit us at www.theshmooze.com, where you can download all the Shmoozin free of charge, as well as view source sheets and address questions or comments on this or any other Shmooze. The Shmooze is completely funded by private donations. We need your help to continue our work. All donations are tax deductible and count as miser. Please help us help others by calling 866-613-TORAH. That's 866-613-TORAH. Or you can make your donation right on the web at www.theshmooze.com.